From WBEZ Chicago, this is Nerdette. I'm Greta Johnson. We did it. We made it to another weekend. Coming up, Xochiel Gonzalez is going to tell us about her new book, Anita DeMonte Laughs Last.
Anita became every artist that I've known that has had struggled to get their art recognized and seen as valid.
But first, it is our chance to sit back and relax with two excellent humans. Here this week is the head of the audio program for Northwestern's journalism program and the author of the upcoming book, We Are the Culture, Black Chicago's Influence on Everything, Ariane Nettles. Ari, hello.
Hi, Greta.
Also here is the host of the podcast, Wait For It, Ronald Young Jr. Ron, welcome to the show.
Hello, Greta. I'm so happy to be here.
Yay. Okay, so before we jump in, pop quiz question. The Oscars are this weekend. What was your favorite movie of 2023? Ron, did you have a favorite?
Ooh,
I'm putting you both on the spot with this one.
I think mine was Godzilla Minus One.
Nice.
Honestly, I mean, I thought through everything, and I know there's probably some more obvious choices there, but this movie snuck up on me and it was really good. So
that's amazing.
Yeah, fantastic.
I love it. What about you, Ariane?
I'm gonna say The Color Purple. I think maybe because I didn't really know what to expect. I am a musical person. And so I think that it had a lot more joy that I didn't expect. You know, like the original Color Purple is a really kind of, it's a heavy, heavy movie. You know, I grew up watching it. And so I don't think I expected to kind of walk away from this when feeling kind of, you know, empowered and feeling, you know, lighter. I wasn't really expecting that. So I think I walked away feeling like kind of thinking about like joy and happiness and forgiveness. And that was not the vibe I expected.
Well, that's beautiful. I mean, what a gift to get to, you know, have all those good vibes. That sounds wonderful.
Yeah, yeah.
Def not the vibes of the original.
Exactly. So that's why, you know, I kind of went in on guard. I think that's what it was, right?
Sure.
I went in on guard, like, whew, let me hold it down.
How they gonna sing this?
Yeah, how they gonna sing this? Let me guard my heart, okay? And then I said, okay, yeah. Let's get some moves in.
Yeah.
Cast me for the next one, okay?
Oh my God.
Put me in the next one.
It's so funny how much expectations shape a movie like that. You know, like if you go in thinking like, uh-oh, this is going to be tough. And then it turns out to, you know, whereas like if you had heard that it was really joyful and fun, like that could totally change your viewing experience. I think
Yes. Like, I mean, I loved Mean Girls, which I think because I saw the
musical.
The musical movie, because I saw the musical on Broadway in Chicago, and
funny.
I was a little like lukewarm on it. So I was, you know, like, it was okay. But I love the movie adaptation of the musical so much more than I love the musical.
Yes.
I was mostly comparing it to that than to the original movie. So I think, you know, it's like it's where your mind is when you're going in.
Exactly.
See, that was the journey I had for Color Purple. I saw the musical and then I saw the movie musical and I was like, this is great. I know, because I went basically if you go the line of adaptation, then you're fine. But I saw Mean Girls, the movie. I never saw the musical. And then I saw Mean Girls, the musical, the movie. And I did not like it.
I can see that. Yeah, no, I can totally understand that. Yeah.
Justice for Regina George. How dare you? Okay,
so I also want to talk about Airplane Mode because there was a court story that came out recently and it puts forth the argument that it is not, in fact, necessary for airplane safety and that it's mostly like, at least these days, a thing because they don't want people to be able to talk on the phone during a flight, which I understand. I am not surprised by this. I am definitely enough of a rule breaker that I have kept my phone out of airplane mode while on airplanes. Usually cell service doesn't work that high up. Ron, you're nodding your head. Did you know this was a thing?
I did not know this was a thing, but I have been leaving my phone on for a while, just like as a rebel to see, like, because one, I knew nothing was going to happen. You're not that much of a rebel, right? But you're like a little bit of a rebel.
Yeah,
but the
you
other
just
thing
think
is,
you're cooler.
Yeah, and now I use airplane mode and do not disturb as a break. Just be like, oh, cool, I'm going to turn this off. And then when I turn it on, I'll have a bunch of messages. It'll be so nice when I land and I'll feel important. But like, yeah, in terms of it disrupting the plane, when did we stop believing that? It's been a while.
Yeah. Yeah. It has been a while. Well, I think too, it's interesting. I mean, I definitely don't want to sit next to someone for 4 hours while they're talking on the phone. That does sound like hell.
I agree, because one time I was on a plane and this like young girl was like FaceTiming her boyfriend or something on the plane. and we know, I mean, y'all know, like the past couple years, flight travel has been really wild and people do not listen to flight attendants when they tell you anything. So you do have to have like a federal regulation to,
right.
you know, make people do stuff. I just didn't want them to admit it because now the conspiracy theorists are going to have more. That's my thing, is don't admit it, right? Because literally, like a couple weeks ago, I was listening to somebody say, it was like a video or something, and they were talking about how there's a conspiracy theory that like in the Denver airport, like in the basement, that's where the Illuminati meets or something.
Oh,
see, that's what I'm saying. Like,
yeah, that's true. I've been to those meetings.
See, exactly. Yeah. So just, you're just giving more. Yeah. And all of us have a little bit of conspiracy theory in us already.
Sure.
So
sure.
When you confirm that you've been lying to us for decades, it just fuels people to be like, see, I told you. It's the CIA that is connected with the federal airline agency, and they work with the Illuminati.
You sound like a barbershop. So that's perfect. You're right, absolutely
exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Don't I sound like a barbershop? So you that do. I've been on a lot of dates where this has been like the conversation. So then that's
like,
why
I know that guy. You're the person that you're doing. Yep. I know that guy.
Exactly. That's why they don't want our phones to work, because yes. what if there's an emergency and we need to make a phone call? They want us to think that they don't work. That is the government playing.
Oh my God. Okay. So another topic I want to discuss with y'all is how tweens are getting super into makeup and like multi-step skincare programs, and Sephora specifically. I think this one is really interesting. Elise Hugh actually had a really fascinating article for The Atlantic about it. And, you know, she talked about how like, essentially, like back in our day, says the elder millennial, you know, Ari, like you would find out about stuff from like your friend's older sister or whatever. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But now all these young people are on TikTok. So it's all like, it doesn't trickle down or take as long for people to pick up on trends. It's just like all there all the time. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine how much pressure these kids are under. Now, I know none of us are parents of daughters, but I know Ariane, like you're an auntie. I'm curious,
yes.
is this, like, has this come up for you? Is this something you're thinking about?
It is. I mean, I'm an enabler. Like, that's why I think before the article started coming out, I'm like, wow, I've literally taken tweens to Sephora. And we've had a grand time, right? Like, I'm buying Clinique. I'm getting them stuff. I'm probably spending so much that then, like, I'm getting like extra free samples. So, you know, then they're like, hey, here's some extra stuff you can give the girls. So we're like, we're racking up in Sephora, okay? One time we had like only like 30 minutes in there and we walked out with so much stuff. Me and some twins.
Supermarket sweep.
Yes, it was a supermarket sweep. 30 minutes, maybe 25 minutes and so forth.
That's so funny.
The thing is that I do think that they could have worse habits, right? Like, especially thinking
For
of
sure.
like skincare. It's like,
you're not buying them cigarettes.
Yeah, and I could see that the argument is that it's like expensive, but I think most of the time they're getting like the smallest version of things, the little trial versions that you see at checkout. And realistically, you know, we have getting rid of all the malls and all the other places that tweens can kind of go and hang out
all
day.
True.
So if they're just going and like putting on extra moisturizers, they're not really hurting anything.
Yeah. What do you think, Ron? Had you like come across this story before I sent it over to you?
I don't like it.
Right?
I don't like it. Because I feel like it's like the subtitle is what like sucked me in. It said products glorifying youth are being sold to actual youth.
Right.
And I feel like we're already surrounded by so much messaging that constantly tells us to hate ourselves.
Right.
And now we're finding out that they're literally pumping it into our kids at a younger age. So for me, I'm like, as a person who talks a lot about weight, I'm like, you don't need to be telling people who are not even fully mature, have not even reached puberty, that they need to lose weight or they need to get their bodies together or their faces or their skin or any of that stuff. Cause like, you're going to deal with acne. Your hair is going to be wild.
Right.
Like
it's going to be weird.
Exactly. You're going to be in that in-between phase and all of that stuff. And it's all going to change as you get older. Like them knowing and having access to the makeup products. I still remember the first time I saw that girls started wearing eyeliner and how that made me feel, you know what I mean? And as that changed through high school, like I always remember, like, you know, makeup's kind of cool. I think I like this. You know what I mean? Like, I get it. But I feel like that's totally different from the messaging that they're getting and that all these folks are in on, which is like, hey, you could look younger. And it's like, she's 12. How much younger does she need to look? Or she's 12. How much thinner does she need to be? Her body's going to change by the time she's 22 anyway. You don't even know what that looks like. So I think the information age is really what's like making me struggle with all of this.
Yeah, it is wild. I do kind of feel like if I had kids, I just would not let them have phones for as long. Like I would just move out into the woods.
Slap it out of their hands. Get that out of here.
I think that messaging is really like key, right? So it's kind of like you got to really like enforce with kids. Like you are great. Like you are perfect how you are. Like, and I know like, you know, no shade to like my parents, but I didn't necessarily get that on my physical appearance. They did tell me that I was smart, but I had a lot of insecurity about my weight, about how I looked. You know, I was like, oh, I'm so fat. I don't look, you know, like I had a lot of insecurities about that. And I think they just probably assumed that I would be fine, but I was like, not fine. And so I think like really combating those pressures and being like, hey, look, no, we're doing this face mask because it's fun. Like it's a fun activity that we're all doing. Look, me, your mom, your aunt, we're all hanging out together on a Friday night and putting face masks on. We're not doing this because there's anything wrong with your face, right?
You
like we're doing this. You don't need this, right? This is more of a, we're doing this for fun. It is an activity, you know? And we're doing it with you because it's fun, not because there is something that you need. And like really expressing that and saying it is important. Yeah. And like, I know I've been like very much, I think it's made me be more confident because I'm like, I can't talk bad about myself because they're going to see that. So I can't even say like, oh, I look bad today or, oh, I know. I have to be very confident in what I say about myself because they're watching.
Yep. You're modeling it all the time.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. So that messaging, I think is just really key. So that's great point.
Yeah. Okay. So I also want to play Burden or Delight with just one story from this week. This is a very simple game. You just tell me whether you think this would be a burden or a delight. This time we are talking about the increase in popularity of owls as ring bearers in weddings. Yes, you heard me correctly. The Washington Post has a story about how in Britain, especially, this is becoming more and more popular to like have birds fly down the aisle with the little ring. They cite the popularity of Harry Potter and like Hedwig as part of the reason for this. I think this is so funny. Ron, I want to start with you. Burden or delight?
It's a burden with a capital bird. Like R. Like, are we serious? Like it's, I get it. And I understand if I went to a wedding in which an owl was the ring bearer, sure, I would be entertained, but I would be entertained by the things that could go wrong. Like, I just want a mouse to go by while that owl is supposed to deliver that ring, and I just want to see the chaos that unfolds when that owl does what an owl does, which would be a predator in that moment. I would love to see that. But other than that, like at my own wedding, absolutely no. We are getting a human or I'll just have the rings in my pocket.
A cute child?
Yes,
adorable.
A cute child. Yes. Like, I like, there's a lot of ironic ways to deliver a ring that don't involve a predator. Owls are predator. Terrifying.
Google
owls, they can turn their heads all the way around.
Sure.
They're always watching you. They don't just sit around eating Tootsie Pops. This is dangerous. This is a burden.
My dear friend Trisha hates birds, says they're like dinosaurs. Which,
they are.
I mean, you know, like,
they're watching.
Uh-huh.
Do y'all not know Watch Hitchcock? They are watching you.
I will say, I completely agree, full burden. Ariane, I can't wait to hear what you're going to say about this one. But the one thing that did, like, sort of give me pause is they, you know, they talk about the average price of wedding in this story, which these days is $35,000, which
absolutely
is
not
completely insane to me. But the bird is only $400 to $600. And like,
that's too
dude,
much.
Dude, if you're already dropping 10, like, what's another $400 though? Really?
That's too much. How many meals is that? What, how much are we paying per meal? That's like four, that's like six more invites.
That's true. That's like Aunt Helen or the bird.
Yes. Like, come on. That's like C-class friends or the bird.
Oh my God. Ariane, where do you land on this one?
Greta, you already know. Okay. This is an absolute burden. Okay. And if you ever have a bird at your wedding, I am running out the opposite side of the door, because I also am afraid of, like, I'm not just like afraid of birds when they're doing their thing, but I'm afraid of, like, when we try to domesticate things that are like out in the wild. Like, let them be. Like, have we learned anything from Jurassic Park?
Yes. Yes.
Let things be. We're not supposed to do that.
Life
We're not
finds
supposed
a way.
To do these things. Because if I were an owl and you tried to domesticate me and make me carry your little funky ring down the aisle, I'm causing chaos.
I'm showing up with my friends.
I'm calling them. I'm doing a little owl call. I'm doing a little owl call, and they're all going to come and meet me. Come on.
I went too far.
No, that was exactly far enough.
Too far.
Okay, well, great. I'm glad we all are in accordance on that. I think that feels right. And I think this is, I think everything is right. This just feels good. So I guess I'm just going to say, Ariane, Ronald, thank you both very much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. I know this is my last time on the show.
This is it. They're going to be like, never again.
They're like, no, we good. The guy that hooted on the show, we good.
Tried it.
Yeah, we tried it.
In just a minute, we are going to hear from Suchil Gonzalez about her excellent new book. Our next guest is the delightful Suchil Gonzalez. She is the author of Olga Dies Dreaming, which was a Nerdette book club pick from 2022. And she is back with her second novel, Anita DeMonte Laughs Last. It is about Anita, an outsider artist who dies in the mid-80s from a violent and mysterious death. In alternating chapters, we also get to know Raquel, an art history student at Brown in the late 90s, who is a fish out of water among the mostly white, mostly rich students at the Ivy League school. She learns about Anita at a critical point in her own self-understanding. And that is all I'm going to say for now, because I knew even less than that when I picked up this book, and I was thrilled by the turns it took. What I will say is that it's about the beauty of making art against all odds, of forging ahead when no one invites you to, and of figuring out how to make space for yourself in the world. So, Chiel, welcome back to Nerdette.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
Okay, so I think we should start with Anita, our titular character. I was really surprised and also not surprised to realize that she's based on a real person.
Yeah, sort of at the end of my college time, I stumbled upon the story of Anna Mendieta. Like, you know, we really didn't have particularly diverse art history classes then at the Ivies in the art history department. And somebody gave me a book on Caribbean art, and I was talking to one of my art teachers about it, who was just kind of a hippie, dippy, liberal white lady. And she was like, you know who you need to look up? Like, Anna Mendieta. And I just kind of went into it, you know? And so I ended up getting
going down this rabbit hole, but it was really late in my time there. And I just, you know, and during the pandemic, I was working on actually the adaptation of Olga that didn't end up getting picked up, but I was deep into production on it. And I kind of had this idea. I was like actually into script writing. And a friend texted me something after we had a notes call. And, you know, it was a joke because the notes call was kind of rough. And I just started thinking about my art history classes and how little I'd seen of women, period. And then women like me, even not at all. And I then found myself thinking about Ana Mendieta. And I was like, I wonder if this would feel easier had I known about her and she'd been like part of the canon, you know, like would all this art making kind of feel easier? And I, at this point, I decided that I was going to fictionalize, you know, fictionalize their story a bit because I realized that I wanted to make her a person and I didn't know how to do that respectfully, if that makes any sense.
Like,
I was
sure,
like,
yeah.
I was like, I'm just going to fictionalize this. And then she, Anita kind of ended up also sort of being this like repository for all my frustrations. She became Ana Mendieta. She became a little bit of me. She became every artist that I've known that has had struggled to get their art recognized and seen as valid. And then she became a force all unto herself. And in the beginning, she was third person. And then realized she had to be first person.
For sure.
Yeah.
That's funny because her voice is so, I mean, she's just like so fierce and prideful and funny and angry and like just all the, like she is so vibrant throughout this book.
I think one of the things that was exciting about deciding to have her be first person and the premise in general, but then once she became first person was, you know, women, when they have deaths, particularly deaths of violence, so often get flattened to the crime, right? And I think it was really exciting to be like, well, how would she feel about this? And I'd be like, she'd be really pissed. Like,
why? She'd like, be fucking mad.
She'd be fucking pissed. It's like, and I'm like, about any number of things, right? And not least because she felt like she was just getting started, you know, and that we didn't get to see all that she could do. And so it was like a really exciting thing to, particularly in honor of Ana Mendieta, you know, to like be like, what would it be like to hear, you know, like after the fact and have agency after the fact and not just end at victim of crime, you know?
Yeah, it's gorgeous. I love it so much. I mentioned your first book, Olga Dies Dreaming. I feel like these books, you know, they're very different, but they also have a lot in common. And I think especially around kind of that idea of like the struggle of like making a voice for yourself, making space for yourself in a world that like, you know, not only isn't built for you, but also like intentionally keeps certain kinds of people down. And I wonder to what extent that's like intentionally a mission for you versus like, those are themes that kind of bubble up based on your own life experience.
No, I think it's definitely part mission in the sense that I think what I'd felt when I decided to sort of start writing was that I hadn't seen, I'd sort of always seen narratives, a lot of narratives that were like how hard it was to try to fit in. Mm-hmm. And I was like, but I want to write about what happens. It's just like, I want you to just like me the way that I am. Like, right. And, and the failure of trying to fit in on other people's terms. And so I think there was some intentionality and then some of it, the weird part about this book, and I know we talked about Anita, but the other character, I didn't mean for that to be nearly as, I sort of thought we just have a couple of coinkydink things, you know, because like I was
that's my next question. Yes. But,
like, it ended up being much more personal. And I think, you know, in this weird way, this book feels more personal than Olga because I didn't mean to walk myself through the day-to-day steps of my existence as an undergraduate and how they may have messed me up at a time. But I definitely realized, I was like, oh my God, this felt inevitable. Like a lot of her kind of sense of loneliness and coping mechanisms, they just felt, I didn't design them to become mine as much as I was walking her through her existence. It felt the inevitable choice, if that makes sense. See, like, I think I saw Olga as being like, I'm so exhausted by trying to fit in. And I think I wanted to see Raquel as like the figure that resisted earlier on.
Mm, I love that.
And that has this courage, right? Like this courage. It's so cool.
Yes. Yes. But has to find it.
Yeah.
You know, like
yeah,
doesn't yeah. initially have it and doesn't wait for someone to give her permission either.
I no, mean, it's just. Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, and that's where I think it's so interesting, the idea of like these two stories intertwining, you know. But I was very inspired by The Hours. Like I was really inspired by Michael Cunningham's book and that weird that it's not a weird song, but like there's this Indigo Girls song. Like I'm really going back to my college days. Like
how long till my soul gets it right? Can any human being ever reach that kind of light? I call on the resting soul of Galileo, King of Night.
Galileo, and just this idea of like people crossing each other, crossing through time. And having some bearing on your life, right?
It's gorgeous. But yeah, I mean, you mentioned the Quinkydinks. There are a number of like biographical bullet points that you and Raquel share.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Some of that's laziness. I couldn't, in the beginning, I wrote a whole draft where it was an unnamed the university, you know? And then it's like, it's the school I picture in my heart. And also, having the art school down the street, as Brown does with Rizzi, is just deeply convenient and creates such a great pretentious art scene at a school that like a pseudoscience art scene. Like it's like we're not really artists, but we could play them on TV. It's like a great way to have a turtleneck, like a black turtleneck kind of scene. And I was like, I kind of have to set it at Brown. And Providence is just such a kooky, cool city. I love Providence so much that it felt like, I don't know, it was a place where I came of age and I couldn't think of a better place to do it. You know, there was something mythical about just being in New England and you know, going to like Newport and like all these things that felt like so like waspy, preppy heaven to me as a kid that I was like, I can't. And then, you know, it's just a certain Brooklyn of it all. And then I thought that was going to be it. You know what I mean? I was like, that's it. We're both like, you know, lower income, like students at this fancy school from Brooklyn with weird family backgrounds. And then it was just like, oh, wow. And then I sent it to a couple of my, you know, I've sent it to a couple of my friends that were, you know, BIPOC students at Brown at the time. And they were like, I didn't know we had the same experience, just in different little verses. Like, and I think we were all just too actively dealing with sort of, I don't know, trauma is kind of an overused word these days, but like actively dealing with like just so much incoming that I don't think we can see that we had these things in common. You know what I mean? Like, it's so hard when you're young.
I mean, that's wild to hear about. What was it like to get those responses from them?
It was intense. And I'll say this, the one that was the most intense was ironically from my college roommate, who was actually, you know, totally upper middle class white woman from Long Island, who I'm still really good friends with. But she was like, I didn't know that this was the way you were experiencing that place. And it was like, and so I don't know, I suspect I'm going to have a lot of conversation. I'm going to be having a lot of heart to heart with old girlfriends from college. A bunch of them are coming to my launch. Like, so I'm really actually excited and they haven't gotten to read it yet. And then my 25th reunion is in May, so that'll be...
Oh, shit.
Like, yeah, that'll be interesting.
You're doing it. Oh, my gosh.
But it's just, I think one of the reasons why I did want to write this in this particular way, and also period, you know, like keep it in a time period, was I think that it's hard now sometimes for younger women. We have so much, I love it, like they have so much agency and like they're so like, I'm not doing this with this dumb guy, you know, like, but like we were so still like performing femininity to some extent. Like feminism was so new, we didn't even know like, did that look like getting a job? Like we thought we joked last reunion, it was like a completely acceptable career track was to go be an administrative assistant at an investment bank and marry somebody there. Like, and that was totally, or like do management consulting for 2 years and then meet somebody and get married. And like, we didn't have judgment really about it. You know what I mean? Like even just for working on it, like I couldn't get over, I was like, oh my God, the things that I was ingesting just sonically, I ordered all these old magazines. Like, I'm like, I texted a bunch of my friends and they're like, we're lucky we're alive, ladies. Like, you know, like the messages around us were just so wild. And I think I wanted to put that, you know, I have more younger readers than I had realized. And I sort of was like, I hope that this will give us some generational empathy too. You know what I mean? Like that it wasn't always the way it is now. And like, I'm sorry that we're a little lame sometimes.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I mean, I interviewed you for Olga, but like, and I would love to trick you into becoming my friend, but like, you know, it's not like you and I actually know each other that well, but it was so interesting reading Anita because it really did. It was like, I could tell how deeply personal it must be even without knowing you that well.
Oh my God. I mean, it was a nightmare to write this book. I'm not even going to lie. Like it was like really personally vicious. And I think I posted something on my Instagram where I was like, I left my heart. Like my friends were worried about me. Like it was really, really rough. Like, because I was writing it while I was still promoting Olga. And it was just, I didn't think it was going to go. There was a draft that was so dark before I made Anita first person. And then I think then she gave me, much as she saves Raquel, she gave me a lot of levity. But on the other side, I felt after Olga, like I was kind of like, in a really good new place about my own family. And I feel like, I felt weirdly more confident since I've written this book about my art and also like kind of my place in writing and talking and thinking about things. You know what I mean? Like, and I think
that's
that
beautiful.
Processing it was kind of healing. Yeah.
That's amazing. What a gift, really. I mean, I'm sorry you had to go through the rest of it, but...
Right, it's the journey, right? Like, I think the good part, I don't know, it's not, like, not to be corny about it, but it's like, you don't always have to suffer for your art. I had a great time writing Olga, actually. I had a fun, it was a blast to write. But I think this was one that, you know, to get there and really make it mean something, that's what it took.
Well, Sochil, I love you so much. This was such a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you for writing another fantastic book. I can't wait for folks to read it.
Thank you. And thank you for having me. And thank you for reading it and then just getting it. And it's so always so nice to talk to somebody who gets it.
All right, that's it for this week. Thank you, as always, for listening along. In case you missed it, also in the feed this week, we have a conversation with Kaveh Akbar for his book, Martyr. That is our March book club selection. It is never too soon to send in a voicemail. You can just record yourself on your phone and then email that file to nerdappodcast@gmail.com. We are taping our conversation about that on March 18th. So do it before then if you want to end up in the show. Of course, our April selection and May also have already been announced. In April, we are reading Beautyland by Marie-Helene Bertino. And in May, we are reading Table for Two, which is a short story collection by Amor Towles. Nerdette is produced by me and Anna Bauman at WBEZ in Chicago and is part of the NPR network. And our executive producer is Brendan Banaszak. We will see you next week.
Sorry. I don't know why. It's stupid. I'm sorry. I don't know why it's funny. Oh, okay. I'm going to randomly do that at the grocery store.